From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A former reality television star is president of the United States and has declared a war on the media. The relationship between presidents and the press has always been fraught with political pitfalls. A free press is enshrined in our Constitution and is intended to be a bulwark against abuses of power, shining a light on wrongdoing and holding politicians' feet to the fire. But today, corporate-controlled media dominate the landscape, and a handful of media outlets enjoy such a cozy relationship with the White House that they're little more than mouthpieces of propaganda. How did we get here? My guest is Mickey Huff, director of Project Censored, president of the Media Freedom Foundation, and he's the co-author with Nolan Higdon of the new book, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America. Welcome to the program, Mickey.
Thanks so much, Sonali. It's an honor to be on your program.
Thanks for joining us. So first, when we talk about the way in which our press has evolved, it seems as though the corporatization of our media is at the heart of this story, that media has turned into a profit-making enterprise rather than fulfilling its original intention, which is to shine a light on issues. Would you say that that is the framework through which we should be studying what's happened to our media today?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, thank you for having me on the program to talk about this really important subject. And as the former FCC chairperson, Nick Johnson, once said, regardless of what your first area of interest is, whatever your first area of civic action or activism or societal political concerns might be, if your second priority isn't reforming media or making the free press truly free and more democratic and more open and transparent and fact-based, transparently sourced, then you're likely to gain little traction in any of your other primary interests. And basically, going from, Ralph Nader sets up a great foreword for the book where he basically talks about this enclosure of the commons, corporate regulatory capture of agencies. And in terms of media, I mean, this has happened across the spectrum. Going back to 1934 with the Telecommunications Act, it was supposed to be that the media, the airwaves belong to the public. But over the decades, we've seen an enclosure, a corporatization, a privatization, all done in the name of allegedly providing more choices, more options for the public. But what we've instead is seen is we've seen a dramatic winnowing of particularly media ownership, cross-pollination between boards of directors, relationships with advertisers for profit. And, what we really see here is a drift away from focusing on what really matters to the public. And instead, what we see media doing is catering to their owners and their advertisers, and in the process, creating a great culture of distraction so that instead of promoting civic literacy and critical thinking, it really kind of promotes hyper-partisanship. And this, again, is not something that we don't believe that this had to happen this way. But as we talk about in the book, how did we get here, right? We start out with Lao Tzu. If you don't change direction, you may end up where you're heading. And in fact, we would say that the media system in the United States has not evolved, but rather devolved into a handful of corporations that really provide almost nothing of substance for the American public in terms of information they can use to participate more meaningfully in our fraying and decaying democratic republic.
So the media coverage of the 2016 election offers a number of illustrations of the greatest problems with our media today. And you write about that in your book a lot. In many ways, you compare and contrast Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's approach to the media and their relationship with the media, which is not something people would expect, right? These were two rivals on opposite sides of a political fight. What are the similarities between their relationship to the media, and what does it say about media?
Well, there are two sides of the same corporate coin, whether it's corporate-controlled political parties, corporate-controlled media, I mean, again, I'm not saying that there's no difference between these candidates, these political characters or political celebrities, I think is probably a more accurate term. You know, Trump himself was a reality television celebrity and real estate mogul. We also saw in Hillary more of a sort of a legacy, a political legacy family, the Clintons, who were responsible in large part for moving the Democratic Party to the right by wooing corporations, banks, developers, et cetera, in the 1990s, when we definitely saw this rightward shift. But overall, we've been seeing the rightward shift dating back to the 1950s. And this is what we do in the book somewhat, is we go back and we take a look at some of these people, some of these influential players like a James Buchanan, you know, not just the Milton Friedmans, which people may know of. We go back and talk about Lewis Powell's memo, and we talk about the Nixon administration war on the press. A lot of this stuff that we're seeing contemporaneously is recycled and rehashed, but it's done so through a newer, more myopic, technologically sophisticated series of media platforms. And what we see is, instead of seeing substantive debate and discourse between two major candidates like a Clinton or a Trump, what we see is exchanging barbs or personal attacks or a barrage of fallacies. And even someone that has as much you know, public intellectual background and public political experience as someone like Hillary Clinton, she couldn't help but get dragged in to this morass of a political circus and sort of a culture of spectacle. And so that's what we wanted to look at. And Nolan Higdon and I, when we were doing this book, which we worked on quite a while, you know, for well over a year, year and a half, you know, we wanted to make sure that this wasn't a book about Trump. And this isn't a book about Clinton either. It's a book about our political culture as it has been shaped by the corporate media, and why we call it a United States of distraction that is defined more by things like hyperpartisanship, media silos, which are then exacerbated by corruption within the educational system, which has moved away from critical pedagogy and critical thinking. And we really, you know, kind of have a more of a news culture that is noise, and it's really difficult for the American public to find what are the actual facts through all the din of this. And so we did go through and take a look, and we talked about Fox News and Breitbart and Sinclair Broadcasting and a lot of the right-wing conservative media in the United States, but we also talked about the ideological biases of the neoliberal press, which particularly, you know, we looked at MSNBC, and, you know, we criticize their type of coverage and infatuation with titillating and sensational stories rather than substantive ones. And if we could define media, political media in the Trump era, I would say that that's basically it. It's as Chris Hedges wrote about a decade ago in Empire of Illusion, we're witnessing the end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle.
Right. So would you say then that because corporate media's goal is profits, their ideology is necessarily shaped by that, whether it's right-wing media or so-called liberal media, which is much more right-wing than they would like to admit, that you end up having a completely different end goal than if you were to try to be a journalist in the true sense of the word? So, for example, can you explain the terrible media coverage of the Bernie Sanders candidacy through the same lens? Because media didn't know what to make of him.
Absolutely, Sonali. And we're seeing a redux of that right now, whether it's the Washington Post or the New York Times, so-called legacy media, media that, of course, back in the day, Richard Nixon would label and libel as the, quote, liberal media. We've certainly seen a great rightward shift there since. The Washington Post at one point ran somewhere between 16 and 20 negative stories about Bernie Sanders during the 2016 primary in one 24-hour news cycle. It's really pretty obvious. In fact, even when the editor at the New York Times was interviewed about this at one point after the election, they acted as if they didn't know where to find people that could accurately report about the Sanders campaign, which is that would be laughable if not so ludicrous and absurd. But, you know, what sums it up for us, and we started the prologue out this way, and, you know, we've written about this too at Project Censored, because it really sums it up. Don't take our word for it. Don't just take the word of the words of Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky in Manufacturing Consent, setting up the propaganda model 30 years ago. Take the word of now ousted CEO Les Moonves of CBS, who was Me Too'd at long last to exit that stage. But in 2016, prior to the election in the summer at a San Francisco tech conference, Les Moonves said this to the audience. He said, "Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS." This Moonves exclaimed while he was executive chairman and CEO of CBS, right, during the Morgan Stanley Technology Media Telecom Conference in the summer of 2016, Moonves further went on to say, "I've never seen anything like this, and this is going to be a very good year for us." He's admitting it out loud, knowingly they're giving Trump too much coverage. 75% of the population of the country, when polled in the United States, said Trump was getting far too much coverage, that the coverage was too sensational and it was not on substantive subjects. And yet the corporate media that love when they get called before Congress, when they have to do hearings and testify about what they're doing with the public airwaves, aerial quotes, they like to say, well, they just give the public what they want. Well, poll after poll strongly suggests that not only is that not true, but likewise, poll after poll consistently shows that the American public skews far to the left of both establishment parties and the corporate media in terms of the way they frame discussion.
And so that's why it becomes really complicated to cover the Sanders campaign, because not only is he talking a lot of policy, which doesn't bring in the ratings that they like or they think that they would get, and of course, his progressive agenda includes undermining the very corporate paymasters of the media, which in itself shows that we have a media system completely biased against progressive political candidates, which in turn reproduces the same system and makes our politics skew rightward and rightward and rightward.
I'm afraid that that is a very accurate assessment, and this is the great conundrum that the more progressive candidates will find themselves. And, you know, that includes others, and I know there's plenty of infighting and circular firing squads on the left that are unfortunate trademarks, if one goes back far enough. But this means we have multiple layers of challenges. Not only do we people having vibrant debate on the actual left in the United States that gets almost no coverage in the corporate press, we at least see candidates that identify with a more left perspective, like Sanders, perhaps less so Warren. And then, of course, there's third parties that get almost no mention other than for derision. But yeah, this is a really significant problem. And in fact, you know, when we were writing this, and it's kind of you're keeping up almost in real time with some of the things that are happening, I actually stumbled across a really apt observation that mirrored the thesis that Nolan and I have in the book. And of course, it was by none other than Noam Chomsky. And, you know, Chomsky, you know, I think nailed it when we categorized what was going on in the United States. And he said it's like a two-level wrecking ball. He said, quote, "Trump's role is to ensure that the media and public attention are always concentrated on him. He's a con man, basically, a showman. And in order to maintain public attention, you have to do something crazy or nobody's going to pay attention. So every day there's one insane thing after another, make some crazy lie. Meanwhile, he's on to something else. And while this show is going on in public, in the background, the wrecking crew is working. Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, the guys in the cabinet, writing executive orders, previously Bannon, now Stephen Miller. What they're doing," Chomsky says, "is, quote, systematically dismantling every aspect of government that works for the benefit of the population. All efforts are being devoted, kind of almost with fanaticism, to enrich and empower their actual constituency, which is super wealth and corporate power, who are delighted. Now, here's the extra challenge. Not only is Trump a master of distraction with Twitter and the failed and crumbling Fourth Estate following it like breadcrumbs hot on some trail of a wild goose chase, but also anytime then we see actual candidates with progressive perspectives that mirror more of what we what the public might be in line with, they have to go through multiple firewalls and they are subject to actual hostility. CNN's debates with the Democratic hopefuls was very hostile and biased towards the more progressive candidates. So, you know, we could go on about this, but this is why it's such a great challenge. Yes, we if we had a Hillary Clinton in office, who won by a few million votes, by the way, right? She was still a corporate candidate. She was still heavily backed by Wall Street, corporate banks, had a very aggressive, bellicose foreign policy of expansionism, pro-NATO. So, you know, the problems we face are, again, bipartisan. But this is why Nolan and I looked at this issue from this other lens of what's been happening myopically in our culture with further and further corporate control and consolidation. As a result, we have less and less representative democracy and fewer avenues of civic engagement.
So do you how do you explain the relationship between the media that Trump claims is the enemy of the state and Trump? Because if you end up accepting that Trump says that there, you know, if you accept what Trump says, you might imagine on the surface that there is that adversarial relationship between at least center left or liberal media and Trump. And so they are the true sort of journalistic, you know, outlets that are preserving the idea of a free press. But you don't think that's the case?
Well, we don't suggest that the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN or even Fox and the Wall Street Journal never report about what's going on or that they never ask critical questions or cover important stories. What we say, however, is often when they do, the way in which they spin or frame it is quite partial and quite biased and tends to be storylines that are pitched to their confirmation bias audiences. Case in point, Trump quite effectively weaponized the term fake news at a time when the Democratic National Committee and the Democratic Party were kind of reeling from their own scandals of bias against Sanders, blaming Russia for Trump's outcome in the election, winning the Electoral College. And Trump basically took the idea that Russians were manipulating the public with fake news and used it against the establishment press, the Fourth Estate itself. And so at Project Censored, for example, we've been critical of corporate media since 1976, but we don't criticize the press in the same way as a demagogue and a political partisan like Donald Trump does for political gain. When we do it, we're doing it as a form of critical pedagogy to promote critical thinking and deep analysis of key issues. And while CNN's Jim Acosta may be sucking himself into the story and violating some of the core ethics of journalism in one way, to suggest that, you know, that he is simply the enemy of the people because Trump says so is to play right into the hand of the political game and rhetorical game that Trump is playing. And, you know, Trump learned, of course, not Trump himself per se, but his many handlers, including Bannon previously at Breitbart, they paid close attention to Karl Rove in the Bush White House. And, you know, as Ron Suskind wrote about the infamous quote from Karl Rove, that the journalists and the people that are paying attention, you know, who historically could communicate to the public the things that were happening, were irrelevant. They no longer mattered in a post 9/11 world, in a post fact world, where the given administration decided they could make up the narrative and they would project where the storyline was heading, and that journalism in the Fourth Estate was simply there to be stenographers and follow them through the paths of history as they forged ever forward. So this is a real problem because, again, it's not that the moniker of fake news is very troublesome and problematic. And it's not a new thing. It's propaganda. It's dis and misinformation. But the way in which it's been weaponized, right, is very dangerous because we now live in a climate where, as a result, too, of some of this other privatization and corporate capture of the public sphere, we have extraordinary levels of distrust in the public of public institutions. from the fourth estate to branches of government, Congress in particular at the lowest, negative opinions of public education and so forth. This was all sown. This was all driven and created purposely through generations of narratives to deride the public sector so that the private sector could come in riding on the white horse looking as some kind of savior. What we're trying to do is deconstruct that. And in order to do so, you do have to have historical framework and an historical lens that says, yes, Lewis Powell wrote in the Powell memo in the early 1970s that they needed, that right wing needed their own media, they needed their own institutions, they needed their own think tanks and academic positions to counter what they saw as a pervasive liberal media bias. Now, through all of this, right, we've always had propaganda. We've always had disinformation. But with the advent of the internet, with further deregulation, and particularly with the proliferation of social media and the fact that majority of Americans now turn to social media for news, even though it's not a regulated journalistic institution, right there, we have a huge problem that fuels the further hyperpartisanship, the media silos, the filter bubbles, and confirmation bias that basically rule our day. And rather than have critical analysis from the likes of someone like a Henry Giroux or a Chomsky or others, we never see those voices on the corporate media. People have to go to the Pacifica Network. People have to go to Free Speech TV. People have to tune into shows like this or Democracy Now! To hear those kinds of perspectives. And we're arguing in the book that there are many, many people that are reinvigorating journalism and that are working diligently to recreate a fourth estate that holds those in power accountable. But they don't get access to the platforms to spread their word. And that's why we need to all network and work together to try to create those possibilities for a better future. The millennial generation is one of the most active politically that we've seen in some time. They've given us the Dreamers, Black Lives Matter. They're on the front lines of the climate crisis. The time is now to pay attention to these historical challenges and to reboot and to reinvigorate our public education and media systems so that we can have a better, more just and participatory society.
Mickey, so let me then ask you the $100 million question, which is always the question, which is how do we fund such a media, right? Because this is the corporate media's excuse for turning to corporations for funding. You see Pacifica stations and independent media struggling to make ends meet because we're living in an era where the internet has reduced journalists to so-called content creators, and content is available for almost free, and so journalists are, you know, underpaid, and it becomes this huge question of how do we, or you have, you know, you find former corporate sugar daddy, right? Like The Intercept has found where you have a single incredibly wealthy person who shares some of their disposable income to fund an independent media outlet, which is then dependent on that one person. So, you know, there's the question, how do we fund these independent media outlets?
Well, you know, if that's the $100 million question, if I answer it correctly, I'll split it with you. And all of our other good friends and colleagues in the alternative independent press, because there are many of us. And, you know, I think that that's the key is how do we fund that? Well, the Knight Foundation and the Annenberg School of Communication, Harvard's Nieman Lab, they've actually been coming up with a number of ways to do this, sinking $300 million into various initiatives. That's happening right now. There's an effort with Free Press in New Jersey to really reboot local journalism. The American Journalism Project, ProPublica, Frontline, Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, the News Literacy Project. I mean, we mention a lot of this stuff in the last chapter of our book. The Poynter Institute, much, much smaller than that, of course. We have initiatives like what we do at the Media Freedom Foundation and Project Censored, or our stalwart independent friends, whether it's Abby Martin's Empire Files, Manar Mahawish's Mint Press News, activists and comedians like Lee Camp, Eleanor Goldfield, Shadowproof with Rania Kalek and Kevin Gostola. You know, I could go on and on here of the many people that are doing absolutely fantastic news and fantastic journalism. But we're all
and most of those people are my friends, and I gotta say they are not floating in money. They're not. There's no extra money to, you know, they're all struggling to get by.
Absolutely. But here's one of the angles that I think Nolan Higdon and I have that dovetails with what we do at Project Censored that might be a little different And that's that we are looking through a prism of critical media literacy education and critical pedagogy. And we teach these skills in the classroom. We teach it from the community college level all the way up through journal, through J school, all the way up through undergrad programs and graduate school programs. And we believe that there needs to be a better nexus and better networking between people that are in public education, civic activism, and literally the media and journalism, so that we can help share and pool these kinds of resources, and that we can possibly go, as we saw Free Press in New Jersey, right? Go literally to the legislature and say, hey, there's a couple of radio stations or a couple of bandwidths here that we could sell off and use this money to kickstart local journalistic initiatives. So there are models, but I hear your frustration. And it's, of course, as you quite aptly put it, Sonali, the $100 million question. What would happen if we all had those kinds of resources? Well, I would argue, and we argue in the book, we'd probably have a society that looked different than the one we have now. And another reason that we focus so much on education in our book is because we have to really start teaching people how to use responsibly social media, think critically about news content, and then become media themselves, have people literally become the next generation of intrepid journalists, truth-telling muckrakers, who understand, like George Selde said in the 20th century, journalism is not, you know, not to be a job is not to be impartial or objective. It's to tell the public what's really going on. And there, again, a lot of the people that we talked about and a lot of the folks that you cover on this program do exactly those things and should be lauded. What we need to try to do, Sonali, is further build our networks beyond our own, you know, sort of fan base, so to speak, for lack of a better term. But the Patreon culture, the gig economy, I mean, look, these are fantastic things because they are what float us. But what we argue in the book in particular is because there's been such a significant corporate capture of public resources, we've been forced outside the public till to go and pick up the scraps of what's left over. And that's not tolerable. And we need to be yelling from the rooftops that not only is that not tolerable, but that is, in fact, what is at the root of the decay of our democratic culture.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Mickey. Really appreciate your time and good luck with the book. Certainly, we need a book like this.
Thanks so much, Sonali. Keep up the great work. It was an honor to be on your show.
My guest is Mickey Huff, director of Project Censored and president of the Media Freedom Foundation, co-author with Nolan Higdon of the book we've just been discussing, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up with our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. Thank you so much, Mickey. Really